honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a story that is tough to wrap our brains around. Before I forget, I want to thank a generous pilot named Dwight Kroll, who flew me across the beautiful Sierra Nevada mountains to the little hamlet of Bridgeport, California. Quite a spectacular final approach coming in over the reservoir there, and Dwight handled it all perfectly. There were some breathtaking views, and then we both got to hear this jaw-dropping story of survival from Dick Burbine. And we're not done yet. Back to this 97-year-old veteran of three wars who we wouldn't have had the privilege of meeting if he hadn't survived against all odds that sinking of the SS Henry Bacon in the Barents Sea on February 23, 1945.
The individual that saved my life and the life of the three other people with me was a sub-lieutenant in the Royal Navy. He tied a heaving line around his waist, jumped into the sea, which is extraordinary. He did not have to do that. Went down, jumped into the sea, took one of us at a time, pulled us back up to the Jacob's ladder to the deck of the destroyer.
And he had to pull you because you couldn't pull yourself up.
We couldn't even help ourselves. We couldn't even loosen our hands from the fire, from the life ring. Mm-hmm. And he broke our hands loose from the ice, tied a heaving line around us to his body, and hauled us up to the deck of the ship. And his name was Ian Rodney Bowden. He was a sub-lieutenant at the time. He stayed in the Royal Navy after the war. He rose to be the commander of the Royal Navy yacht, one of the highest ranks in the Royal Navy. And he passed away a few years back. He did come to Tracy to see us. We had a good time, a few drinks, reminiscing. I've got some pictures of him up there if you're interested in that. One of the finest men I've ever met in my life.
You said you had a few drinks. Do I have to ask what you were drinking?
Royal Navy rum and Coke. He blew his mind when he saw the Royal Navy rum. He said, there it is. In fact, I gave him a quart so he could take home with him, and he laughed about it all the way.
What did that mean to you to have that opportunity almost 60 years after the war to meet him and be able to thank him with the lens of all the things you'd done since then?
I was able to thank the man personally, hug him, and thank him honestly for saving my life, sincerely believing that had it not been for him, I would not be there to even welcome him home and thank him.
Yeah, and your son who's with you here in Bridgeport, he wouldn't be here either. There's a lot of things that would be a lot different. I'm wondering about the other part of that equation, because you shared how you helped the women and children into the lifeboat and then how you gathered up those three other guys in the water. I'm sure you had some encounters later on with some of those people. What kinds of things did they say to you?
The only one I ever encountered after that was I was able to sail with two of them. Woodrow Wilson Posen, I sailed with him after the war. And Blackie Wildridge, William Blackie Wildridge, I sailed with him after the war. They were both engine officers, same as I was. Woodrow Wilson Posen, the last I heard of him was he was working on the Seattle Space Needle when they built the Space Needle. Remember that? Mm-hmm. He was one of the heavy operators on that when he were on that. It's the last I heard of him. He passed away years ago. Blackie Wildridge, he lived about approximately 6 years after the war, and he passed away. He was a young man, too.
Well, and that brings up another question. I mean, when you go through as extreme of a situation as you survived 78 years ago, have there been lasting effects? Have there been things you've had to deal with because of what you went through that day that most of us wouldn't even think of?
Never. I don't dwell on it. I never even think of it unless something comes in the paper or that jogs my mind.
So you haven't had problems with your fingers or your toes or anything else?
Never had any problem of any type like that.
Just the lump on the back of your neck?
And it's not a lump so much as it is a concave. Uh-huh. With the lifeboat hit me in the back of the neck and it sort of concave my neck. But other than that, no. William Burr, I don't know if you heard of him or not. He was a young 18-year-old seaman at the time. 25 years later, they found his body on the shore of Norway, completely preserved, not a mark on him, frozen solid. And to this day, they put a monument at the exact spot that he was found. And his body was interred in Arlington National Cemetery.
I guess that's one thing we haven't had you tell us. How many people were on the ship? How many survived? How many didn't make it?
27 of the crew died, not counting the Navy gunners. And to this day, I don't know of any of them. In fact, I'm sure that I'm the last one that survived. Campbell, which was the radio operator, passed away about 4 years ago. And he was the last one that I communicated with at that time.
Well, and what about those who died that day? I'm sure you knew some of those people, right?
I knew the whole crew, every one of them. Like I say, I've never been able to communicate with any of their families or any of their relatives, so I don't know if any of them are still living or not.
Well, I bring that up because, you know, there were 406,000 Americans who gave their lives in World War II, and you came as close as anyone possibly could without being one of them, but here are dozens of your shipmates who made that ultimate sacrifice. What can you tell us about them? How should we remember them now?
I would remember each and every one of them as a friend, a loyal American, and a seaman to the day they died. They were just good, rugged seamen, and they did their job. They did it proudly, and they did it without any fanfare or any of that nature. That was part of that was their job. That's what they did, and they did it well. And I was proud to serve with each and every one of them.
And you've made it clear that your mindset was, I'm going to survive no matter what. And that got you through it. But when you tell someone this story and you see the look of disbelief on their face, or you even look back at it now at age 97 and try to figure out how in the world things happened the way they did, how do you explain it? How do you explain the impossible somehow being possible?
Well, since I was old enough to even reason, I have always believed two things. One, you are born on a certain date, and two, you're going to die on a certain date, regardless what or how or when. When your time is up, your time is up. If it's not, you're going to live it through like it wasn't even there. And I'm a firm believer, and I still believe that.
Well, and that's why you're still so active volunteering for the Forest Service and all the other things you're doing. This is your 36th year volunteering for the Forest Service. What do you do for the Forest Service?
My son and I, we do all the campground maintenance for down dead hazardous trees so that nobody can get in there, a tree fall on them or shatters or anything of that nature. We just cut them out and take them out. And we do not sell the wood. We keep the wood for our own service, or we give it to the local people here in Bridgeport that need it. There's five different people that we have given wood to year after year because they can't afford to pay $480 a cord for wood. They're widow women and so on, men that are crippled and can't do that themselves. So that's what we do.
Do you know any other 97-year-olds who are out there with chainsaws chopping up big old redwoods?
You put me in a spot. No, I don't. I don't know anybody that, at that age that are still doing that. In fact, all the people that I have worked with through the years are all passed away, and they were all good, hard-working woodsmen.
Why do you still do it?
A love of nature, and I enjoy working. Working is my pride and joy, and I've always been that way. I'm made out of a good Irish and Canadian Canuck Indian blood, and I think it's some of the finest blood in the world, especially the Irish blood. We take a toast, but never go too far.
Mixed with a little bit of British Royal Navy rum, huh?
Absolutely. It goes a long way. And that's the finest drink I've ever had in my life, and I've traveled all over the world. And I have never had a better drink than the Royal Navy rum.
Well, and I mean, I really could sit here for hours in every corner of your walls in here. Did you do the woodwork in here, by the way?
Yes, I did. I did all the woodwork. Joe and I did this ourselves.
I had a feeling.
Something I'd like to tell you, though, that you might not have ever heard before. I wear a hat with three war veteran on it. A lot of people ask me, well, when were you in Vietnam and what did you do? I said, I was in Vietnam 5 years before Vietnam was Vietnam. And they look at me and say, what the hell are you talking about? I said, I was in Vietnam when Vietnam was French Indochina. I was fortunate enough to go to Sidi Bel Abbes, North Africa. We picked up the 13th Demi Brigade of the French Foreign Legion. Before they came aboard, they welded an 8-foot cyclone fence completely around the ship. And I said, what the hell going on? And they said, you'll find out in a minute. The 13th Demi Brigade of the French Foreign Legion come aboard. We went through the Suez Canal. Gun ports on each side of the ship. If any French Foreign Legion went over, That's what that 8-foot fence was, desertion. They shoot them on the spot before they even got off the fence. We went through the Suez Canal. We took them to French Indochina, Adak. They went in from the beach, from Adak to Bien Bien Phu. Bien Bien Phu is a bowl. They died to the man, including the colonel. That's the God's honest truth. That's how I became acquainted with Vietnam.
Well, and I was going to ask you about what happened in between, because I mentioned when we first started that, you know, once a Marine, always a Marine, but before you were a Marine, you're in the Merchant Marine, and I see your 1st Marine Division patches over there, and I see a helicopter, and it says Korea, 1950, 1954, but I got to ask you what may sound like a dumb question to you. If you should have died in World War II, and it's a miracle you survived, why in the world did you join the Marine Corps after that?
This is my country, and I die for it. In fact, I was in Korea when the Korean War started. I was in Busan when the Korean War started. We come back from Korea to the United States is when I went and joined the Marine Corps. This time, no qualms about being blind or anything else. The Marine Corps needed some gunfighter, and I went in the Marine Corps. And I was lucky enough to go back to Korea, and I was with VMO-6, the 1st Combat Helicopter Group in the Marine Corps. We saved 8,000 Class A evacs.
And again, since so many people know so little about the Korean War in general and specifically about what you were doing in VMO-6, when you say 8,000, that's a big number, especially since this is just a few at a time. So you say crew chief. That's a lot of different responsibilities. Give us a taste of what some of the things you were doing were on a daily basis.
On our daily basis, we were repairing rotors, engines, replacing engines, or whatever that might be. Anything wrong with the helicopter, our responsibility was to service it and have it flyable.
And how would one of these evacuations work? Can you give us an example maybe of one of them that was memorable?
Well, to bring you back to in place, the high mountains in Korea were phenomenal. The aircraft that we were flying, Franklin engines, were not strong enough to support the aircraft and gain altitude or build a cushion under them. The engine was not strong enough for the weight of the aircraft and the evac. We've been on some mountains in Korea where we put the two evacs on the line, had to actually push the aircraft off so it would get a cushion so it could take off. And I mean, with the evacs in place, actually get on the side of the chopper, one on each side, and push it off the mountain so that it would drop down and finally build a cushion so it could fly away. That's the God's honest truth.
So yet again, this is a pretty dangerous duty where a lot can go wrong, a lot can kill you.
I'll put it this way. Death is your neighbor. It's there with you constantly, and you know it, but you ignore it because it would drive you crazy if you just accepted it.
And you spent quite a long time over there, huh?
36 months. I volunteered to stay over twice, and on the third time, which was a year at a time of voluntary stay, I stayed twice, did my first hitch, did two extensions, and the commandant of the Marine Corps said, send him back to the States, he's going to Asiatic. So I came back to the States. They wouldn't let me stay for the third tour.
And I'm just guessing there were some other things that happened during 3 years there that probably stand out to you. And it probably got close to as cold there as you did in the water off Norway, huh?
Yeah, it was an accepted fact. I mean, you were in a combat zone and you did exactly what had to be done at the time. And you didn't stop to think of a good, bad, or indifferent. You did it because that was your duty and that's what you were there for. And that's the way it was.
Again, I don't want to leave anything out that's important to you. But one thing I really don't want to forget to say is thank you. Thank you for serving our country in so many different ways. You're still serving your community and so many people who don't even know what you're doing. And thank you for telling us a story nobody else could tell us. I want to ask you a couple more questions, and then if there's anything else you'd like to add, feel free. One, if you think back over 97 years, is there something you'd say that you're most proud of or most thankful for?
For living that long.
And you're still living. You're not coasting. You're not easing into the end here.
I don't believe in being idle. I was born a worker, and I was remain a worker till the day they bury me. I like to work, and I use my hands, and it keeps my body fit. It's some of the best medicine in the world is to keep busy. That's what my firm belief.
And because of that, because you're so active and engaged and forward-thinking, I'm wondering if there's something that's on your list that you haven't checked off yet. Is there something you're still looking forward to, still hoping to do or experience or accomplish that hasn't come to fruition yet?
I often wish especially when I get up in the morning. I'm full of piss and vinegar. I often wish that I was younger again where I could do it all over again. And I would. I'd serve my country all over again the same way.
Even February 23rd, 1945?
Even February 23rd, 1945. If I had to do it all over again, I would voluntarily do it for my country. And I am proud of this country, and I love this country, and I'll die for this country if I have to.
Dick Burbine, 97 years young. I don't think there's much more to be said. Although, we did have a little more with Mr. Burbine that wouldn't fit into our radio time. You can find that, as well as some thoughts from his son, in the podcast version of this episode at hometownheroesradio.com. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we'll be reminded once again, as we were so powerfully by Dick Burbine's incredible story of survival today, that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.